first festival, and I think the present surprised him. I hadn't heard of any more efforts to enlanguage himself. I'd said nothing about any of them to him. Before now, the humans came. A host, a lie-athlete, one of the professors, I realized, was speaking. Before the humans came, we were... And it stalled. One of its companions continued. Before the humans came, we didn't speak so much of certain things. A sensation went through the audience. It was followed by another speaker. Before the humans came, we didn't speak so much. I'd learnt enough to know this trick. A collaborative faux mendacity. The last was repeating the previous sentence, but dropping its voices to near nothing at the final clause. Of certain things was said, but so quietly the audience couldn't hear it. It was showmanship, fakery, a crowd pleaser, and the crowd were pleased. Arnold stiffened and said together, "Tesh Eshel." Beehive. It was swaying. Its gift wing circled, its fan wing stretched. It stepped up to the lying ground. There were two main ways the few Arieke who could lie a little could lie. One was to go slow. They would try to conceive the untrue clause. Near impossible, their minds reacting allergically to such a counterfactual, even unspoken, conceived without signification. Having prepared it mentally, however successfully or un, they would pretend forget it to themselves. Speak each of its constituent words at a certain speed, at a beat, separated, apart enough in the mind of a speaker that each was a distinct concept, utterable, with and as its own meaning, but just sufficiently fast and rhythmic that to listeners they accreted into a ponderous but comprehensible and untrue sentence. The liars I had thus far seen with any success were slow liars. There was reputed to be another technique. It was the more base and vivid, and by far harder. This was for the speaker to collapse, in their mind, even individual word meanings, and simply to brute utter all necessary sounds, to force out a statement. This was quick lying, the spitting out of a tumble of noises before the untruth of their totality stole a speaker's ability to think them. Tesh Eshel opened its mouths. "Before the humans came," it said in ornery staccato, "we didn't speak." There was a long quiet, and then a convulsion, a riot. I wished very much that I had any understanding of Arieke in body language. Tesh Eshel might have been exuding triumph, patience, or nothing. It hadn't whispered the second half of any truth, or trudged sound by metronome sound through a constructed, unconstructed sentence. What Tesh Eshel had said was unquestionably a lie. The audience reeled. I reeled. The hosts woke in their third instar suddenly fluent, language a direct function of their consciousness. Millions of years back, there must have been some adaptive advantage to knowing that what was communicated was true, Sile said to me, last time we hypothesized this history. Selection for a mind that could only express that. The evolution of trust, I started to say.
There's no need for trust this way, he interrupted.
Chance, struggle, failure, survival, a Darwinian chaos of instinctive grammar, the drives of a big-brained animal in a hard environment, the selection out of traits had made a race of pure truth-tellers.
This language is miraculous, Sile had said.
I was somehow repulsed by it, in fact. It was astonishing, given what language needs to do, that the Arieke had survived. That, I decided, was what Sile must have meant, so I agreed. If evolution was morality, they would be unable to hear lies, too, like two-thirds of the fabula monkeys, but it's more random and beautiful, so that was only the case for those few who managed to speak them, of their own little untruths. Unbacked by signifieds, the lies of language were just noises to their own liar. Biology's lazy. If mouths speak truth, why should ears discriminate between it and its opposite? When what was spoken was, definitionally, what was?
and by this hole in adaptation, though or because they were not built to say them, the host could understand lies, and either believe them, belief being a meaningless given, or, where the falsity was ostentatious and the point, experience them as some giddying impossible, the said unthinkable. It's I who's monomaniacal here. It's unfair to insinuate that all hosts cared about was language, but I can't fail to do so. This is a true story I'm telling, but I am telling it, and that entails certain things. So, the hosts cared about everything, but language most of all. Radical and cussed, Tesh so. Escher got that lie out into the world, a vomit of phonemes against his own mind. The public were rapturous. We'd witnessed a rare performance. I was delighted. Ambassador Arnold was astonished. Hasse was bemused. Valdic and Seil were aghast. Latter Day 8. Kedis and Shirasi were being escorted to the embassy. The newscast's little Vesp cam saw them. Mid-level staff gathered troikas and quads from the Kedis community, a few Shirasi think captains. Vehicles arced over our roofs, antennas in the girders of our construction, over the white smoke from our chimneys. One shot recurred on the bulletins, a young staff member swatting at the cam through which we saw. He must have been very tense to be so unprofessional. The newscasts, voice and text, were flummoxed. Perhaps to most locals, there'd been no sense of crisis until this ingathering of our exots. The pods that took them to the ambassadorial explanations flocked with birds and fist-sized cams that rose and fell among the birds. Beyond Embassy Town, the oddness of angles and movements that had touched the city seemed to be spreading. I buzzed Ursel, Randolph, Simon, but could get through to no one. After a hesitation, I tried Wyatt, but he didn't answer either. My handset still contained Hasse's number and Valdic's and several other similes. It had been a long time. I considered calling one. What does it matter now? I thought, but I didn't do it. I'm sure I wasn't the only one doing so, but I began to prepare for whatever it was. I was copying what data I thought precious, hiding treasured objects, packing essentials into a shoulder bag. I'd always been fascinated at how my body ran things sometimes. While I felt like I was agonizing, my limbs did what was needed. Night would come without my noticing, and the aioli breath was still cool. Then, on this crucial change moment, I remember there were night bird noises and the gibbering of local animals. It wasn't yet so late that there was no traffic. I wasn't tired at all. It was hard to make sense of the shots from Embassy Town that I was watching. The newswear was still processing. A human commentator said, "We're not sure what... We're seeing something from the city. Movement from..." The figures in cam view were Arieke. The Arieke were moving. On my screen and through my window, I saw corvids frantic in several directions in the air. I heard things. I was already leaning out of my house, and I saw their source. The hosts were coming out of their city, into Embassy Town. I ran to the interzone between Embassy Town and the city. Lights came on as people woke to the noise, but though I was joined by more and more blinking citizens, I didn't feel part of anything. I passed under light globes whispering where moths touched them, below arches I'd known all my life, and, tasting the thinning air, I knew I was only a street or two from the edge of the city. I was in Beacon Street, which swept downhill out of our enclave. It was an old part of Embassy Town. There were plaster griffins at the edges of the eaves. Not far away, our architecture was overcome, the ivy that tugged it smothered by fronds of flesh matter and Ariekine business. The bio-rigging probed plaster and brick in a rill of skin. The hosts filled the road, jostling each other with odd motion. A single host had grace, but en masse they were a herd, in slow stampede. I'd never seen so many. I could hear the slide of their armour, the tap-tapping of thousands of their feet. Zells scuttled. As they came into the human reach, the street lamps and the colours of our displays made them a psychedelia. Rumpled women and men in nightclothes lined the walkways. So the Arieke entered Embassy Town with us either side as if to greet them, as if this were a parade. Cameras darted overhead, little busybodies. There were hosts in all their sentient stages, from the newly conscious to those about to slip into mindlessness. Hundreds of fan wings fluttered, and I wanted to be above, looking down at that, a camouflage of shuddering colours. They passed me. I followed them. Many Tear watching could understand language, but of course none of us could speak it. Some couldn't restrain asking in Anglo-Ubic, "What are you doing? Where are you going?" We trailed the Arieke north, climbing the incline toward the embassy, on the roadways and verges, crabgrass and our debris. Constables had arrived. They waved their arms as if moving us on, as if they were protecting our aging walls. They said things that had no meaning at all.
"Come on now," or "Move away there."
Human children had come to stare. I saw them play ambassador, duetting nonsense noises and nodding wisely as if the Arieke were responding. The hosts took us a coiled route, amassing onlookers, cats and alt foxes bolting before the aliens. We came past the ruins. Several ambassadors, Randolph, Magdar, Edgar, I saw, emerged from the dark, constables and staff around them. They shouted greetings, but the hosts didn't pause or acknowledge them. The ambassadors said,
"Ursh!
Stop! Wait! Stop!" "Friends," they shouted, "tell us what we can do. Why are you here?" They retreated at the head of the Ariakine crowd, ignored. Someone had turned on the light of a church, as if it were Uta Day, and its beam rotated overhead. The hosts began to speak, to shout, each in their two voices, a cacophony at first, a mix of speech and sounds, I think, weren't speech. And out of that came a chant. Several words I didn't know, and one I did.
Ez.
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 The Arieke spread out before the black stone steps of the embassy. I walked among them. The hosts let me in, moving to accommodate me, glancing with eye corals. Their spiky, fibrous limbs were a thicket, their unbending flanks like polished plastic. My littleness was hidden, and unobserved, I watched the ambassadors panicking.
"Ez,"
the hosts kept saying. The people of Embassy Town were saying it as best they could, too. "Ez Ra," an undeliberate chant of the same word in two languages, the name. Joaquin and May Bell debated in furious whispers. Behind Jasmine and Arnold and Magdar, I saw Calvin. They looked stricken. Staff were bickering too, and the constables around them looked close to panic, their carbines and Geist guns dangerously at the ready. A host stepped forward.
"Dar Shahura Eshez,"
it said. "I am Shahura." One of those that had greeted Ezra at the arrival ball.
"Hello,
Shahura,"
said. "We are here for
Ez.
Bring
Ez.
And on."
Joaquin tried to speak, and Maybell, and the host paid no attention. Others joined in with it, its demand. They came slowly forward, and it was impossible not to have a sense of their bigness, the sway of their shell-hard limbs.
"We have no choice,"
I heard Hua or Kin, and I thought it was to Maybell, but saw with shock that it was to Quinn or Hua. The ambassadors unhuddled, and stepping out from among them, coming forth as if in a conjuring trick, was Ez Ra. Ez looked anxious. Ra was card-sharp blank. As their colleagues parted for them, Ez gave them a look of hatred. At the top of the stairs, Ez Ra looked down at the congregation. The Arieke spread the tines of their antlers of eyes wide to take in the two men.
"Ez."
Shahura
spoke again. The language fluent among us meant what it said was quickly communicated. "Ezra," it said. talk. Ezra will speak to us, or we will make it speak.
You can't do this!
Someone from staff or ambassadorial ranks shouted, and someone else answered.
What can we do?
Ezra looked at each other and murmured a preparation. Ez sighed. Ra's face remained set. Friends, they said. Ez said Kurish, and Ra, lower. Friends. There was a snap of Arieke thoraxes and limbs. Friends, we thank you for this visit, Ezra said. And the Arieke reeled, buffeting me. Friends, we thank you for this greeting, Ezra said. And the ecstasy went on. Ra continued to mutter for instants, but Ez had gone silent, so language decomposed. The hosts hubbubbed. Some flailed their gift wings and wrapped themselves within them. Some entwined them with others.
Chahura
shouted speak, and Ez spoke again. They said pleasantries, emptinesses, polite variants of hello, hello. The Arieke concentrated, as if asleep or digesting. Around the plaza, I saw hundreds of embassy towners and soundless hovering cams.
You stupid, stupid bastards, someone said on the embassy steps.
The words were as ignored as the ivy. Everyone was looking at the hosts. They were coming back from whatever it was had happened to them.
Good,
said one. It wasn't
Chahura.
Good. It turned.
Chahura
did so too. The Arieke all turned back the way they had come.
Wait! Wait!
It was Magdar.
Pharos! We have to...
One of them gestured to Ez and Ra, don't speak again. Magdar conferred and shouted in language.
We must speak, they said.
Whether out of pity, courtesy, curiosity or whatever,
Chahura
and other leaders, if that's what they were, of the gathering craned their eye corals, twisted them backward, looking behind them. I heard someone say,
put it down, officer. Christ, man.
We have much to discuss, Magdar said. Please join us. May we ask you to enter? Constables and sec staff came through the crowd.
Go.
One stood before me. She held a stubby gun. She spoke to me rapidly, the same spiel she was giving everyone.
Please, clear the streets. We're trying to bring this under control. Please.
Like everyone else, I obeyed my orders slowly. The Arieke had arrived in strange coherence. Now most of them straggled away at random, leaving their scent and unique marks in the dirt. An urgent-faced boy in a constable's uniform whispered to me to, please fuck off right now. And I sped up a little. The ambassadors were trying to usher a few hosts, those who'd hesitated, into the embassy. They didn't seem to be succeeding. Part 3. Like as not. Formally 7. After the festival, Sile disappeared. He wouldn't answer my buzzes, or did so only with terse comments and promises to return. Wherever he was, he might be blanking me, but he had conferred, I suspected, with unlikely people. I was with Valdic and Shanita a day after the festival when Valdic was buzzed. When he'd answered, he shut up and glanced at me with wide-open eyes. I had been abruptly sure that Sile was on the line. After a couple of days, my husband came back to our rooms, and we had the fight that had been simmering for a long time. As with most such, the specifics are uninteresting and largely beside the point. He was surly and pissy and made little quips about how I passed my time, barbs at least as anxious as they were nasty. Not that I was in the mood to care about that. I'd had enough of his recent predilection for gnomic pronouncements and his bad temper.
Who do you think arranged that trip, Sile?
I shouted. He wouldn't answer or look at me, and I didn't put my hand on my hips or gesticulate. I folded my arms and leaned back and stared down my face at him like I had the first time I'd met him.
Some people might think thanks were in order, Not days of this sulky shit. What makes you think you can behave like this? Where did you fucking go?
He made some reference that made it clear he had been with ambassadors. I stopped abruptly at that, halfway through a riposte. What, in Imma? I remember thinking. Who buggers off to high-level meetings when they're having a hissy fit?
Listen, Sile said. I could see him deciding something, trying hard to calm our altercation. Listen, will you please listen?
He waved a paper.
I know what it's trying to do. Serl Tesh Esher. It practices, and it preaches, to its coterie. This is what it's been saying.
He didn't say how he'd got the transcript.
You similes, he said. The hosts aren't like us, okay? It's not exactly most of us who'd get excited to meet an objectival phrase or a past participle or whatever, but it's no surprise some of them would want to meet a simile. You help them think. Someone with reverence for language would love that. But who'd want to lie? A punk is who. Avis, listen. There are fans, and there are liars, and only Serl Tesh Esher and its friends are both.
He smoothed out the paper.
Are you ready to listen to me? You think I've just been sitting in a cupboard for the good of my health? This is what it's been saying. Before the humans came, we didn't speak so much of certain things. Before the humans came, we didn't speak so much. Before the humans came, we didn't speak.
He glanced at me.
We didn't walk on our wings. We didn't walk. We didn't swallow earth. We didn't swallow.
Sile was reading nervously, quickly.
There's a tear who swims with fishes. One who wore no clothes. One who ate what was given her. One who walks backward. There's a rock that was broken and cemented together. I differ with myself than agree, like the rock that was broken and cemented together. I change my opinion. I'm like the rock that was broken and cemented together. I wasn't not like the rock that was broken and cemented together. I do what I always do. I'm like the tear who swims with fishes. I'm not unlike that tear. I'm very like it. I'm not water. I'm not water. I'm water.
No translations I'd ever seen of host pronouncements were properly comprehensible, but this read different. I realized a counterintuitive affinity. For all its strangeness, it sounded a little, a tiny bit, more like, less unlike Anglo-Ubic than most language did. It didn't have the usual precise and nuanced exactnesses.
It's not like most competitors trying to force out a lie,
Sile said.
It's more systematic. It's training itself into untruth. It's using these weird constructions so it can say something true, then interrupt itself to lie.
It didn't perform most of these, I said.
It's been practicing, he said. We've always known the hosts need you, right? You and the rest of you, like the split rock, like they need those two poor cats they stitched into a bag. They need similes to say certain things, right? To think them. They need to make them in the world so they can make the comparison.
Yes, but... I looked at the paper. I read over it.
Tesh Esher
was teaching itself to lie.
I'm like the rock that was broken, Sile said. Then, not it. It can't quite do it, but it's trying to go from I'm like the rock to I am the rock. See? Same comparative term, but different. Not a comparison anymore.
He showed me old books in Hard or Virtua. Liesenberg, Lakoff, Usenhi, Ricoeur. I was used to his odd fascinations that helped charm me ages ago. Now they, and he, made me uneasy.
A simile, he said, is true because you say so. It's a persuasion. This is like that. That's not enough for it anymore. Similes aren't enough.
He stared.
It wants to make you a kind of lie, to change everything. Simile spells an argument out. It's ongoing, explicit truth-making. You don't need logos, they used to call it. Judgment. You don't need to link incommensurables. Unlike if you claim this is that, when it patently is not. That's what we do. That's what we call reason, that exchange, metaphor, that lying. The world becomes a lie. That's what Serl Tesh Esher wants, to bring in a lie.
He spoke very calmly.
It wants to usher in evil.
I'm worried about Sile, I said to Ursul. Arviz, she said to me at last, after I tried to explain to her. I'm sorry, but I'm not sure what you're saying to me. She did listen. I don't want to give the impression that all she did was tell me not to tell her. Ursul listened, but I'm not sure to what. I was hardly exact. I couldn't be. I'm worried about Sile, I said to Calvin. I tried them instead. He's gone a bit religious. Pharotecton, one of them said. No, not church, but... I'd gleaned more scraps of Sile's emergent theology. I call it that, though he was adamant it had nothing to do with God. He wants to protect the Arieke from changing language. I told Calvin about the temptation, what Sile thought Tesh Eshel planned. He thinks a lot's at stake, I said. I still love this man, and I'm afraid of what's happening, I was saying. Can you help me? I don't understand why he's doing what he's doing, what's making him afraid, how he's able to make it even get to me. Something like that.
Let me talk to him, Calvin said.
The one who hadn't spoken looked with raised eyebrows at his doppel, then smiled and looked back at me. Formally 8. Calvin, as they'd promised me, spent time with Sile. My husband's research was intense, antisocial. His memos to himself were everywhere, and mostly not comprehensible. His files scattered across our dat space. The truth is, I was a little scared. I didn't know how to react to what I saw in Sile now. The fervor had always been there, but though he tried to disguise it, after that one conversation, he didn't talk about his anxieties to me. I could see it was growing stronger. That he tried to hide it confused me. I wondered if he thought his concerns were the only appropriate ones to the shifts in some host's practice, and if the lack of such anxiety from the rest of us was devastating. If he thought the whole world mad, forcing him into dissimulation. I went through those of his thesis notes, appointment diaries, textbook annotations I could access, as if looking for a master code. It gave me a better sense, if still partial and confused, of his theories. What do you think? I asked Calvin. They looked put out by my uncharacteristic pleading. They told me there was no question that Sile was looking at things in an unusual way, and that his focus was, yes, rather intense, but overall, not to worry. What a useless injunction. To my surprise, Sile started coming to the cravat with me. I thought we would do less, not more, in each other's company. I didn't tell him I knew he'd been previously on his own. I saw no evidence of more efforts to persuade the hosts to speak him. Instead, he began to exercise a subtle pull on some of the similes. He took part in the discussions, would imply certain of his theories, especially those according to which similes represented the pinnacle and limit of language. Communication making truth. Slightly to my surprise, no one made him, unsimile outsider, other than welcome. The opposite, really. Valdic wasn't alone in listening. Valdic wasn't an intelligent man, and I was worried for him. I mustn't exaggerate. I think Sile seemed himself, only perhaps more focused than previously, more distracted. I no longer thought we could stay together, but I wanted to know that he was all right. These were in other ways not bad times for me. We were between reliefs. It was always deep in those days that Embassy Town became most vividly itself, neither waiting for something nor celebrating something that had happened. We called these times the doldrums. Of course, we knew the more conventional use of the term, but like a few other uncanny words, for us it meant itself and its own opposite. During those still, drab days, cut off on our inner outskirt, without contact, a long time after and before any Myabs, we turned inward. Fiestas and spectaculars, on the spare day at the end of each of our long months, our crooked alleys interwoven with ribbons and full of music. Children would dance wearing trid costumes, their integuments of light overlapping and crystalline. There were parties, some formal, many not, some costume, a few naked. This doldrums culture was part of our economy. After a visit, we had luxuries and new technology to invigorate our markets and production. When one was due, there was a rash of spending and innovation, out of excitement and the knowledge that our commodities would soon change, that new season goods would be an expensive vogue. Between, in the doldrums, things were static, not desperate but pinched, and these fates were punctuations and meant small runs on certain indulgences. One night, I was in bed with Calvin. One of them was asleep, the other was stroking my flank, whispering conversation. It was a rare thing to be with one doppel only. I felt a strong urge to ask his name. I think now I know which it was. I was running my finger over the back of his neck, the link in him, beautifully rendered in the hollow below his skull's overhang. I looked at its twin, on the sleeping half of the ambassador. "Should I be worried about Sile?" I said. The sleeper shifted, and we were still a second.
"I don't think so," my companion whispered. "He's onto something, you know."
I didn't understand. "I'm not worried that he's wrong," I said. "I'm worried that he's... that..."
"But he's not wrong. Or at least, he's pointing out something."
I sat up. "Are you saying..." I stood and paced, and the sleeping doppel woke and looked at me mildly. Cal and Vin conferred in whispers, and it didn't sound like simple agreement. "What are you saying?" I said.
"There are some persuasive elements to what he says."
It was the newly woken doppel who spoke.
"I can't believe you're telling me..."
"I'm not. I'm not telling you anything."
He spoke impassively. His doppel looked at him, and then at me, uneasily.
"You asked us to keep a watch on him, and we are, and we have. And we're looking into some of the things he's saying. An eccentric he may be, but Sile's not stupid. And there's no question that this host..."
He looked at his doppel, and together they said, "Tesh Eshel." The half of Calvin who had been talking continued,
"Is definitely pursuing some odd strategies."
I stood naked at the edge of the bed and watched them, one lying back and looking up at me, the other with his knees drawn. "I admit defeat. I've been trying to present these events with a structure. I simply don't know how everything happened. Perhaps because I didn't pay proper attention, perhaps because it wasn't a narrative, but for whatever reasons, it doesn't want to be what I want to make it." In the streets of Embassy Town, a congregation was forming. Valdic appeared to be at its centre. It was Valdic who expounded the theories now. My husband was a canny man, even in his obsessions.
"Valdic Drummond's at the centre of it now," Calvin said. "Valdic? Really?"
"I know it sounds unlikely," I said.
"Well, he's an adult. He's making his own choices."
"It's not that simple." I knew Calvin were right and wrong at the same time. Most embassy towners did not know or care about any of these debates. Of those who did, most would consider them pretty unimportant. Secure, and there was a security in it, in the certainty that hosts could not lie, whatever a few agitated similes insisted. For those who knew about the festivals, a few hosts determined to push at the boundaries of language was too obscure a phenomenon to be any kind of problem, let alone a moral one. That left only a tiny number of embassy towners, disproportionately the credulous. But their number was growing. Valdic speechified at the cravat on the nature of the similes and the role of language. His arguments were confused, but passionate and affecting.
"There's nothing like this anywhere," Valdic said. "No other language anywhere in the universe, where what's said is truth. Can you imagine what it would be to lose that?"
"It isn't fair what you're doing to Valdic," I told Sile on one of his rare visits to what had been our home.
"He's not a fucking child, Avis,"
Sile said. He was collecting clothes and notes. He did not look at me as he rummaged.
"He decides what he wants."
Walking near the ruins, I was handed a flyer on cheap Nantech paper that flashed a trid as I unfolded it. It made me start. It was Valdic's face, apple-sized, in my hand. "Drummond," it said, "on the battle against the lie." a time and place, not the cravat, but a little hall. With it brought my attention. I noticed details of that and similar meetings guerrilla-coded into wall screens, hacked nuisance trids. I went. I'd thought I'd find Sile, but no. I stayed at the back of the room. Valdic wore a projector, and trids of him appeared throughout the temple, random and staticky. At the front of the room I saw Shanita, Darius, Hassa and other similes and tropes. Valdic preached. He was still a middling speaker. I don't know how this mediocrity amassed a following. Something about the doldrums. He expounded religiose foolishness.
Two voices, but one truth. Because what is the truth but dual, bifurcated, not in conflict, but two forms of one truth?
And so forth. The place wasn't a quarter full. It contained indulgent friends, the curious, refugees from other cults. A convocation of the hopeless and bored. When I got home, Sire was speaking down the line. He smiled an unconvincing greeting at me as I came in, turned so that I couldn't hear him nor see his mouth move. I wondered whether, if Valdic were removed from this self-appointed office, with what I was convinced was Sile's instrument confiscated, his mania would dissipate.
"What should we do?" Calvin said. "These meetings aren't illegal."
"You can do anything you want."
"Well, we could have Drummond taken for administrative detention. But do you really want that?"
"Yes," I said. But of course I didn't. And of course they wouldn't do it.
"Listen," they said. "Don't worry. We'll watch Sile. We'll keep him safe."
That they did, though neither in the way, nor from what, I'd assumed. Formally 9. Someone released a viral ware into the vagrant autumner of Embassy Town that gave them Valdic's mania. It made them preachers in his new church. Their eloquence depended on the sophistication of their processes. Most were little more than ecstatics, but a few were sudden theologians. They ambled as they always had, but now accosted us and exhorted us to defend prelapsarian language. Language, we poor sinners. The rhetoric was kitsch, doomed forever ourselves to speak with a deep structure of a lie, but at least granted service to the double tongue of truth. And more like that. Patches were programmed and released, and did their job, but the infection was tenacious. And for weeks, these tramp priests proselytized, their catechisms changing as their ware degraded and threw up Protestant, variant sects.
"We are the stewards of the angels,"
I was told by one machine that staggered like a supplicant.
"We are the stewards of the speaking angels, of God's language."
The virus shut down when its resultant theories strayed too far from emergent Drummanian orthodoxy. I asked Ursel if she was concerned, if she'd felt the tickling of virtual germs. She dismissed the other Autumner as mental weaklings and told me that yes, though she'd felt it, she'd hardly been in danger herself. Of course, Valdic and his radical similes were suspected, but no one could prove who had programmed it. And though it was a nuisance, that was all it ultimately was. I knew Sile didn't have the expertise to program, or I'd have thought it his doing. When I went back to the cravat now, I did so for socially diagnostic reasons. Many previous regulars no longer drank there. Alienated by Valdic's Vatic pronouncements, they set up refusenik simile salons. Others had taken their place. I went to hear Valdic speak, out of what I told myself was a pornography of doomed causes, and maybe to listen for grounds to demand some intervention. He hymned the ambassadors, in his model, interceding hierophants, expressed gratitude at being simile, truths, language in flesh. Tesh Eshel was there, with Spanish dancer and others at the last of Valdic's gatherings I went to. The host had amassed more followers too, so I thought it must be improving its technique, a better and better liar. They watched each other. Valdic glowered. I didn't know if the hosts felt his hostility. Hassa was there, one of the few who retained friends on both sides of the emergent simile split. He acknowledged me, his face displaying an emotion for which I've no name, It reminded me of my own. An unease is as close as I can get to it. "Aren't you worried?" I asked Ursel.
"I told you," she said. "I'm immune."
"No, I mean, what do you reckon? Do you ever think about it? I mean, does it ever make you feel anything one way or the other? That some of the hosts are learning, well, can talk their way around truth now?" She said nothing, so I said, "Can lie." We were in a bar in one of Embassy Town's shopping streets. Ursel, in her minor notoriety, was being glanced at by slightly moneyed youth. We spoke quietly under music and the clatter of glasses. Ursel did not answer me.
"Something's changing, which may or may not be a good thing," I said finally.
She looked at me with a projected face that, by design, or a coincidence of ambiguous stimuli responses in her wear, was inscrutable. She said nothing. I grew more and more uncomfortable in that enigmatic silence until I talked about something else, to which she responded as normal, with all the exaggerated intimacies of our friendship. It never meant that much to me one way or the other that I was Simile. I didn't care what Valdic preached. "It's Sile," I said to myself. But no, though I was worried for him, that wasn't all. I never really knew what else it was. "So what's being done?" I asked Calvin. Even the ambassadors were concerned now, I gathered. The new philosophy couldn't have had more than a score or two of serious devotees, but fervour unnerved us in Embassy Town. The hosts must surely have picked up some atmosphere. I'd seen more Arieke than usual in the Aeolian breath of our quarter.
"We're talking to the hosts," Calvin said. "We're going to organise a festival here in Embassy Town, to stress that it's theirs, too, to speak in."
"Okay," I said slowly. I'd never heard of an Ariekin event in Embassy Town. "But is that supposed to... What are you doing about Valdic?" One of Calvin stared at me, the other looked away. I was angry, and I tried to work out with whom. Sile was ensconced somewhere, with radical similes or the staff, and would never respond to me now. And that seemed to concern no one. There I was, between cliques and secrets. I couldn't tell if I was perspicacious or paranoid.
"It's the doldrums, Arvi," Ursel said to me later.
"This is what happens. You're talking as if it's end time.
I think..." She paused. "You're upset because of Sile. You care about him. And he's gone from you."
She stumbled, exactly like someone who thought would. Arieke representatives came in flyers to plan this hybrid festival. I was often in the embassy, floking, and I came to know them all. One tall and thick-set Arieke's had a mark on its fan wing like a bird in a canopy of leaf, so I called it Pear Tree.
"This is what we need," Calvin said. "We're all too tense. There'll be a parade, and stalls and games for Tear, and a festival of lies for the hosts."
"What about Valdic?" I said again. "And what about Sile?"
"Valdic's nothing. Sile we've not seen for a couple of weeks."
"So where is he?"
"Don't worry. It'll be okay. Honestly, this event will put pay to a lot of these problems."
I thought it was absolutely absurd. No one agreed with me. In all my life, I'd never felt so alone. The festival was to take place in a piazza near the southern edge of Embassy Town. It was christened the License Party, a pun on lies and sense, I was told. I never got what the sense referred to. Signs went up displaying that idiot name, and a necessary explanation. Valdic lived in Embassy Town's east. There was a balcony in front of his door overlooking a leisure canal, and a garden full of flowers and birds, altbirds, local fauna.
"Arvis,"
he said slowly when he opened the door to me. If he was surprised, he hid it. "Valdic," I said, "can you help me? I need to find Sile." His relief was visible.
"Is everything all right?" he said.
"Yes," I said. "No, I just... I haven't seen him for days. My hesitation was real, though my main reason for being there was not Sile, but to assess Valdic and his theology. He let me in, and I saw the trappings of his new beliefs. Papers everywhere, all the crazy Kabbalah and misplaced rigour of a sect.
"Me neither," he said. "I'm sorry. I don't know. I think he's still with Calvin and the others."
"They haven't seen him for weeks," I said.
"No, they were with him a few days ago."
That silenced me.
"He was at the cravat, and they came for him,"
Valdic said. "When?" I said. "Who?"
"Calvin and some staff."
"Calvin," I said. "Are you sure?"
"Yes."
Valdic didn't sound like a prophet. I had to leave. I could hardly focus on his beliefs at that moment. When finally Calvin next said they had time to see me, I was careful to be good company. We ate together. They spoke mostly about the license party. One day, one night, half another day. Calvin emerged from their ablutions equalized. Their accrued blemishes were gone or replicated. I said nothing. I watched them sleep, watched their skins take on differential marks from cotton and the unconscious motion of their hands. When one or other would half wake, I would be waiting. I would try to murmur talk to them, gauge what Cal or Vin said. It was strange, trying to do something I'd not known could even occur to me. "He on my left," I decided at last, murmured my name with a care I recognized, smiled with something really warm. It was desperately hard to tell with only these night-fuddled moments, but he on my left, I decided at last, Cal or Vin, was the one who liked me more. I put my fingers to his lips, made him wake without sound. He opened his eyes. "Cal," I whispered, "or Vin. Tell me. I know he won't." I indicated the sleeping other. "I know you've seen Sile. I know. Where is he? What's happening?" I saw my mistake. I saw it the instant I moved my hands. "You," he said, and though he was quiet, I could hear his outrage. That I'd try to find out secrets, and that I'd do so by this blasphemy. My expression was frozen in misplaced intimacy.
"How dare you?"
I cursed. He sat up. His doppel shifted.
"You have some bastard nerve, Avis," the man I'd woken said. "How dare you? If we've seen Sile, it's not your business."
"He's my husband."
"It's not your business. We're taking care of things, like you begged us to, and you come here and treat us like this. Do this."
Beside us, the newly woken doppel was rising. I looked at him and felt shame. How could I have misseen it? There it was, that thing I'd thought I detected in his brother.
"You thought he was me," he said.
I saw hurt and other emotions.
"How could you?"
he said. His doppel added,
"Do this."
The raging one stood, sheets puddling on the floor.
"Get out," he said. "Leave. You are damned fucking lucky we don't pursue this." "I can't believe you did that," said the other quietly. "This is over,"
the standing one, Cal or Vin, said, and his doppel, the man I should have woken, looked up at him, looked at me, shook his head, turned away. I left the room, having ruined my own plan. On my way home, through the night, I cursed myself. I passed a little tour of Arieke, murmuring in language, as they looked like curators at our lamp-lit dwellings. Formerly 10. At various fairs and events in Embassy Town, I'd been asked to tell stories of the Immer. I'd shown trids and images of my hours in the out, supposedly for children, though there were always many adults in the audience. The Immer was and is full of renegades and refugees. They emerge where they can and do what they can get away with. I'd tell the stories. I had transported most things to most places, Jewelry, immer miserable livestock, payloads of organic garbage to a trash planet state run by pirates. I'd save the best for the end, a changing display of the Pharos that marks the edge of the known always. Here, right beside Arieka. I'd show it through various filters, culminating in the tropeware that made it a lighthouse, a beacon in murk. See? That's what you see. That's right here. Beyond us, there's nothing charted. We live at the end of the light. I was amazed at how addictive the spook and thrill was. My presence wasn't requested this time for the license party. What happened between you and Calvin? Ursel asked me. I didn't tell her, or anyone. The microclimates over the city and those over Embassy Town were rigged according to a complex algorithm I'd never bothered to decode. I was always vaguely charmed by planets enthralled to their tilt, with seasons that were more or less predictable. In Embassy Town, I noticed particular weathers, of course, but didn't ever expect them. It grew warm. It was apparently time for us to have a summer. I went to the license party alone. When I realized that she was expecting us to go together, I had to tell Ursel no. From her silence, I know I hurt her, or spurred the subroutine of her Turing wear that manifested as if that were so. But I couldn't be there with anyone. I wasn't punishing her, because this had not been Ursel's only silence recently, but I needed to be alone for whatever would happen. I knew that something would, as certainly as if this were a last chapter. There were game rooms, food halls, massage houses, places for sex, and there were zones designed for our hosts. They came in large numbers, informed by their networks, the tech-like town criers that we had helped to automate. I'd never seen so many hosts in Embassy Town. Fortune tellers and performers were on the streets. Trid caricatures of passers-by flashed in and out of existence. We came in through security. Tear-tech detectors of metals and energy flows, and bio-rigged proscenia that snuffled as we came through, tasting for the telltales of weapon compounds. There were constables in the crowd. With night, the humans and Kedis grew more drunk or drugged. Children ran on frenetic missions. Autumn wandered in. I saw a pod of adolescent Shirasi, a lone Panagetch casting dice. The hosts spectated as we played our shovepenny games. They looked with tourist fascination, listened to the songs our singers sang, titillated by our harmonics. I couldn't find Sile. I don't think the Arieke ever empathized with our predilection for symmetry and hinge points. Solstices, noon. But the license party was ours as well as theirs, and the Festival of Lies started at midnight. The marquee was the size of a cathedral. In places, the bio-rigged skin hadn't finished growing, and decorative gauze or plastic were woven over the holes. There was theatrical seating for Tear around the arena, and standing places for exots and for the hosts. I saw people I knew. They shouted my name. I saw Hassa, and he raised his hand. He looked afraid. He was gone too fast for me to reach him. By the main performance space was a large group of ambassadors. Calvin was there, and Charlotte, Joaquin, and Magdar, and Jasmine, and others, conferring with staff. Arieke were near them, one or two I recognized. Pear Tree and the others that perhaps I might call leaders. Beyond them, performers waited, host and Arieke. Tesh Eshel was there, with Spanish dancer and the others of its entourage. It wasn't hard to recognize. There was a hush, whispered Tear excitement when the lights went down and a few colored illuminations fired. In a strong, projected, doubled voice, Ambassador Charlotte stepped into the center of the spectators. Spoke language. A translator shouted to us locals theatrically.
It's raining in here, the ambassador says. It's raining liquor on us.
It sounded as though they were trying to excite Embassy Towners with these feeble falsities, as if we were host, and I thought it absurd. But, over the delighted noises of the Arieke looking up to find the rain that wasn't there, came the shrieks of Tear. My neighbours yelling delight at each new untruth from the ambassador, as if none of them could lie. I reached the front as Charlotte came to the end of their set. Other ambassadors performed. They were building an arc for the listeners, I realized, for us. Here were lies that were a comic interlude. Here, a ratcheting up of tension. Here, a moving moment. When, after long, heady minutes, they were done, hosts stepped up in their place. Each Arieki spoke only one or two short lies. Most did it by verbal trickery, like a whispered final clause. Each success was marked with tear cheers and Arieki in approval. Many competitors stumbled and said something true. The host audience responded with what could have been scorn or could have been pity. I stand. I don't stand. This before me is not read. Tesh Eshel stepped forward at last for a scheduled confrontation. Opposite it was an ambassador, Lucy, moving like pugilists, swinging their arms as if limbering. I realized I was surprised that when I'd read about this contest, I had thought it would be Calvin representing Embassy Town. Ambassador and host squared. This was some blasphemy, I thought. Who could have allowed this? There was cheering, but I heard a man beside me, as if channeling my opinion, muttering, "This is not right." Before the humans came, we didn't speak so much of certain things, Tesh Escher said. The MC was shouting the rules of the standoff. Before the humans came, we didn't speak so much of certain things, Tesh Escher said again, and shucked its wings. Whatever alien feelings it was feeling, they looked to us like bravado. The two women of the ambassador and that intricate big beast, the Arieki's, stared at each other. The ambassador opened their mouths. Before they spoke, Tesh Escher said, "Before the humans came, we didn't speak so much." Ruckus. "Before the humans came," the host went on, and I knew what the lie would be. "We didn't speak." It said it clearly. There was a moment. Then the Arieki stuttered in their ecstasy of reception. Even the tear knew that we had heard something extraordinary. There was noise everywhere. Some shouted argument. I saw jostling in the crowd.
"Not true!" someone was shouting. "Not true!"
Men and women were got suddenly, violently, out of someone else's way. They screamed and parted. I could see the man coming, and it was Valdik.
"Not true!" he said.
He ran and shouted and brought a cudgel down on the ground, and I felt a spasming report. There was energy in his weapon. So much for security. He faced Tesh Escher. Valdik shouted that it was not true. He raised his weapon. Eye coral strained. People were running toward us. Valdik shouted,
"Fucking snake!"
Tesh Escher watched him, its coral spreading wide as horns. I heard the bark of a weapon, and Valdik went down, his club scorching the floor. Constables grabbed him. He was beaten down.
"He went for a host?"
People were gasping. I could hear Valdik still shouting,
"The devil! He'll fucking destroy us! Don't let it lie!"
None of the Arieki made a sound. The officers hauled Valdik upright finally, blood smeared and ragged, hardly conscious. They began to drag him, his feet scratching on the floor, out of the grounds. Tens of seconds had passed since his attack. In that whole hall, I think I was the only person watching Calvin and their silent colleagues, one of the very few not staring at the battered would-be assassin being taken away. I saw Sile. He was with them, among the ambassadors and staff. That was it. That was where to look. They were looking not at Valdik, but at Tesh Escher, and beyond it at Peartree and its group of Arieki. I was one of very few in that hall who saw what happened then. Peartree moved. From behind it stepped Hasse. He walked quickly. Even Tesh Escher was still looking at Valdik. No constable saw Hasse coming, or were there to intervene. They were busy suckers to the oldest faint. I moved. One of Tesh Escher's eye buds glimpsed something, and the whole coral arced backward to stare. I saw Spanish dancer, heard it calling, its giftwing moving in alien distress. Hassa aimed a bio-rigged thing, a ceramic carapace, a pistol grip that gripped him back. He fired. No one was there to stop him. He fired, and the gun animal opened its throat and howled. He blasted Tesh Escher across the lying ground, spraying mud-coloured host blood. It broke apart as it flew. Hassa didn't stop firing. The assault tore Tesh Escher's giftwing from its body. Its legs dyingly scuttled, so insectile it was appalling. It gushed from everywhere. Then Hassa was snatched out of my sight himself by a constable's bullet. By the time screaming started again, I was beside him. I trembled. I struggled for breath, as if I were beyond the aeoli. Hassa stared without sight. I heard the rattle of scoot from Tesh Escher's posthumous fitting. Spanish dancer traced shapes with its wings, its colours flushed. I'd never before seen Arieki in grief. I looked at Pear Tree, which looked down at me. I ignored the commotion and all the wails in the room and watched Pear Tree and Calvin and Sile. I remember I moaned every time I exhaled. They were looking at Hassa's body without expression. They must have seen me. That is how the most virtuoso liar of the Arieke was murdered. The days after that were as you'd imagine. Chaos, fear, excitement. No host had been harmed by an embassy towner for hundreds of thousands of hours, for lifetimes. Suddenly we felt we existed on sufferance. Staff imposed a curfew, gave the constabulary and sec staff extraordinary powers. In the out, I spent time in cities and colonies under dictatorships of various forms, and I knew that what we had was a quaint approximation of martial law. But for Embassy Town, it was unprecedented. I had so much sadness in me. I cried, only when I was alone. I was so sorry for Hassa, silly, secret zealot, and for Valdik, who I still believe never knew he'd been a distraction, and whose loyalty to Sile was such that, after that night, he went to his execution denying that anyone else had had any hand in his plan. So sorry for Tesh Escher. I never knew what emotion would have been appropriate for an Ariakin loss, so I settled for sadness. For a day, I turned off my buzz and did not answer when anyone came to my door. The second day I kept the buzz off, but I did answer the knocking. It was an autumn I'd never seen before, a whirring anthropoid outline. I blinked and wondered who'd sent this thing, and then I saw its face. Its screen was cruder than any I'd seen her rendered on before, but it was Ursel. "Avis," she said. "Can I come in?"
"Ursel, why do you load yourself into..."
I shook my head and stepped back for her to enter.
"The usual one doesn't have these."
She swung the thing's arms like deadweight ropes.
"Why do you need them?"
I said. And Faro Tekton, bless her, she grabbed hold of me, just as if I'd lost someone. She did not ask me anything. I hugged her right back, for a long time. I went back once more to the cravat, set my expression, walked a floker walk. None of the similes were there, nor, I think, did any ever come back. I let my show drop. But the owner, a man whose name I had never bothered to learn, referring to him only by the vernacular slang handle we'd granted him that I now cannot remember, hurried up to me in agitation, as if I could help him. He told me that Arieke was still coming. Spanish dancer, one we'd known as Baptist, others of the professors. They'd been staring at where the similes used to sit.
"Serle Tesh Escher used to come here all the time," I said. "Maybe they're coming to be where their friend used to be."
The owner was terrified the hosts would commit reprisal for Tesh Escher's death. Most people were. I was not. I'd seen Pear Tree step aside for Hassa and say something to him on his way. I'd seen Calvin and the others waiting for that. Tesh Escher had been murdered, but it also had been executed, publicly, by its peers. For heresy, Tesh Escher had been sentenced to death by human. Embassy Town couldn't know, and would not. The situation must be made to look to most people, and did, like a bloody mess, rather than the careful, juridical moment it also was. Arieke traditioners had decided they could not tolerate Tesh Escher, would not brook its experiments. A lie was a performance, a simile was rhetoric. Their synthesis, though, the first step in their becoming quite another trope, was sedition. I would never assume I understood the motivations of any exot, and I had grown up knowing the thinking of the hosts was beyond me. Whatever drove the Ariekin powers to their brutal decision might not, be comparable to the calculations that had also gone on behind embassy doors. The Ariekin resistance to these innovations might have been ethical, or aesthetic, or random. It might have been religious, or a game, or instrumental, an expression of some cool, cynical calculation, a power jostling among cliques. I remembered Cal or Vin's anxiety when they told me that some of Sile's ideas about Tesh Escher made sense. The ambassadors, as much as its Ariekin judges, had seen in it an approaching danger. I never thought Cal Vin saw whatever that coming badness was as my husband had, but where there's commitment and dissent, there might be change, and perhaps that was enough. There'd been a catastrophe on its way that, together, Arieke and Ter had staved off, a problem they had solved. Who could I tell? If I could prove anything, so what? Not everyone would think any of this the slightest crime. And what would I bring on myself? I'd no idea how many of the ambassadors knew, or if they would disapprove if they did, or what they would do to me if I complained. I can't have been the only one who worked out what had happened. There were enough snatches of information. But staff asserted horror and shock, and stressed to embassy towners that they had apologized to our hosts, and that Hasse and Valdik had both been brought to justice. They unleashed harsh policing against the remnants of the Drummond cult. Sile moved at last into the embassy, became staff. One day, all his possessions were gone from my home. Among his flaws wasn't cowardice. I think he was avoiding me. Perhaps he